Stations beginning now the transmission of 10 two-minute news recaps for the year-end packages. The transmission begins with the beep tone for cut LN1. It's 5 seconds from Mark.
The plane that carried the 52 American hostages from Iran on America's Inauguration Day didn't leave Tehran until after Ronald Reagan was president, and Jimmy Carter, who had worked for 14 months to get the hostages home, was out of office. But Carter saw the results of his efforts 2 days later in Wiesbaden, West Germany, when he met the 52 who arrived there for a few days of rest and reorientation, and where he spoke angrily of their treatment.
The acts of barbarism which were perpetrated on our people by Iran can never be condoned. It's been an abominable circumstance that will never be forgotten.
Over the next days, the hostages made their way to West Point for reunions with their families. And on January 27th, they flew to Andrews Air Force Base near Washington for a motorcade to the White House through streets choked with cheering well-wishers waving thousands of yellow ribbons. At the White House, the 52 became 53 again, with the addition of hostage Richard Queen, released because of illness. And there was a welcome from President Reagan.
You've come home to a people who for 444 days suffered the pain of your imprisonment, prayed for your safety, and most importantly, shared your determination that the spirit of free men and women is not a fit subject for barter. Let terrorists be aware that when the rules of international behavior are violated, our policy will be one of swift and effective retribution.
And a response from the chargé d'affaires at what used to be the American Embassy in Tehran, Bruce Langen.
53 Americans who will always have a love affair with this country. Mr. President, in very simple words that come from the hearts of all of us, it is good to be back. Thank you, America, and God bless all of you. Thank you very much.
But by year's end, the hostages had mostly faded from the public consciousness, with the lack of media attention a relief for many who had grown weary of their notoriety. This is Bill Small.
Cut LN2.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
And will, to the best of my ability.
High noon, January 20th, 1981. Chief Justice Warren Burger administers the oath of office to Ronald Reagan, the 40th President of the United States. It is a ceremony with the usual fanfare befitting a presidential inauguration, the first to be held on the Capitol's West Front, a symbolic gesture to Mr. Reagan's Western roots. There is time for the new president to revel in the history of the moment. Hail to the Chief is played for the new chief executive for the first time. And President Reagan acknowledges the cheers and applause of the 10,000 or so spectators lining the Capitol's West Front. In his inaugural address, President Reagan sounded a hopeful note. He called on Americans to begin an era of national renewal. He said it's time to realize, as he put it, we are too great a nation to limit ourselves to small dreams. In his speech, Mr. Reagan set out his priorities for the coming 4 years. Among other things, he set as a goal the control of the bureaucracy, as he put it, bringing the government back within its means.
The economic ills we suffer have come upon us over several decades. They will not go away in days, weeks, or months, but they will go away. They will go away because we have the capacity now, as we've had in the past, to do whatever needs to be done to preserve this last and greatest bastion of freedom. In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Mr. Reagan quickly added it was not his intention to do away with government. Rather, he said, it was his intention to make that government work. This is Merrily Cox.
Cut LN3.
President Reagan was leaving the Washington Hilton Hotel after a speech to a labor group. He waved to a small crowd waiting near his motorcade. 6 shots rang out. Mr. Reagan was shoved into the safety of the bulletproof limousine. The car roared off, leaving behind three wounded men, a Secret Service agent, a D.C. police officer, and White House News Secretary Jim Brady. At first, it seemed that Mr. Reagan had escaped unscathed, but a few minutes later, he arrived at George Washington University Hospital. The president walked into the building but stumbled and went down on one knee before he was lifted to a stretcher. First official word on the president's condition came from Secretary of State Alexander Haig.
We have informed our friends abroad of the situation. The president's condition, as we know it, stable, now undergoing surgery.
But Haig, in the turmoil of the moment, made a misstep that would haunt him long after.
As of now, I am in control here.
Later, after the president left the operating room, his longtime aide, Lynn Nofziger, provided some extraordinary details about that harrowing afternoon.
He told Mrs. Reagan, honey, I forgot to duck. And then when he got into the operating room, he looked at the doctors and he said, please tell me you're Republicans.
Dr. Dennis O'Leary, the hospital spokesman, was equally upbeat in answering reporters' questions about the president's post-operative condition.
He was never in any serious danger. The bullet was really not very close to any vital structure.
O'Leary's account was on the rosy side. Mr. Reagan was in serious danger. But by early summer, the president was back to horseback riding and chopping wood. And there are two postscripts. John Hinckley, the accused assailant, attempted to hang himself, but was cut down in time. And Jim Brady, shot in the forehead, partially paralyzed, left the hospital for good just before Thanksgiving. His comeback described by doctors as nothing short of a miracle. This is Roger Gittins.
Cut LM4.
Right on.
Senators and cabinet members applauded as Sandra Day O'Connor approached them on the stone staircase of the United States Senate. With the setting sun illuminating the great marble portico of the Supreme Court across the street, she stood and offered thanks to the Senate that had just voted by 99-0 to let her become the first woman justice.
I'm absolutely overjoyed with the expression of support from the Senate. And my hope is that 10 years from now, after I've been across the street at work for a while, that they will all feel glad that they gave me the wonderful vote they did today. And I'll certainly work hard to make that happen.
Her confirmation fight had been bloody despite the unanimous vote finally cast for her. As a state judge and state politician in Arizona, she had taken several relatively liberal positions on abortion. The moral majority shrieked its opposition to her confirmation. But fellow Arizonan Barry Goldwater, the granddaddy of the conservative movement, leapt to her defense with a personal attack on moral majority major domo Jerry Falwell. He had said all good Christians should oppose O'Connor because of her abortion views. Goldwater's normal reserve cracked in an interview on Capitol Hill.
Well, you know what I said about good Christians.
No. How was that again, sir?
Well, I don't think I can use it on the air, but ass.
Let us be the judge of that.
Ass isn't a dirt. I said all good Christians should kick him in the ass.
The ridicule apparently got to Falwell. He never appeared to testify against O'Connor. The highly touted political power of his politico-religious group was found to be wanting. O'Connor went through several days of hostile questioning and emerged triumphant, guaranteed a place in history. This is Pye Chamberlain on Capitol Hill.
Cut LN5.
The space shuttle program almost became NASA's multi-billion dollar boondoggle. The shuttle itself became the most complicated machine ever built. Getting it off the ground was no easy feat. The idea was to build something you could launch like a rocket and bring back to Earth like an airplane. That meant a lot of innovation, and that meant coping with many unforeseen problems. Trouble with the shuttle's heat-resistant tile system, meant to protect the spacecraft and the crew from the searing heat of re-entry, caused the most serious delays. Finally, on April 12th, the problems were solved and the first space shuttle, christened Columbia, was airborne. With astronauts John Young and Bob Crippen aboard, Columbia's maiden flight was almost flawless. After 2 days in space, Columbia sailed to a landing on the Rogers Dry Lake bed at Edwards Air Force Base. More delays followed as NASA prepared for the Columbia's second flight, the true history maker. Equipment problems and human error delayed the shuttle's second launch by nearly a month and a half. On the day Columbia was supposed to lift off again, some dirty lubricating oil forced another week's delay, with the countdown clock only 31 seconds away from T-minus zero. Finally, on November 12th, 7 months to the day after Columbia's maiden flight, the United States made true space history as the shuttle became the first manned spacecraft to fly in orbit more than once. Merrill A. Cox watched as NASA's Hugh Harris counted down the launch.
Coming up on 10, T-minus 10, 9, we have go for main engine start. We have main engine start. Minus 3, 2, 1, we have ignition. We have ignition of the solid rocket boosters and liftoff. Liftoff of America's space shuttle, and the space shuttle has cleared the tower.
A boom? And the shuttle is on its way.
Controlling the mission control.
A burst of fire, a cloud, and you may be able to hear the incredible roar.
The second flight was supposed to last about 5 days, but trouble with a part of the shuttle's electrical system cut the mission in half. Nonetheless, NASA pronounced the second shuttle mission an unqualified success and began plans for a third test flight scheduled for the spring. This is Bob Honig.
Cut LN6.
The French-built Mirage jets of the Egyptian Air Force were swooping low over the reviewing stand as President Anwar Sadat reviewed his armed forces on October 6th. Sadat, like many of the people on the stand, was looking up at the planes when things suddenly began to go wrong on the ground. Four figures in uniform jumped from one of the trucks rolling past the reviewing stand and ran towards the president. It wasn't until a hand grenade exploded against the railing and they opened fire that anyone realized they were trying to kill Sadat. And then it seemed to take a long time before Sadat's security men began firing back. Dr. Osama El-Bas, the number three man at the foreign ministry, later tried to defend the security men's actions.
It was in the middle of the show, of the air show, and people were looking upward the sky to follow the jets coming from backwards. And it took only 20 seconds for them to move. There was an element of surprise.
Sadat was hit 5 times, and he died in the Mahdi Armed Forces Hospital 2 hours later. Vice President Hosni Mubarak was quickly nominated to take his place, and when Secretary of State Alexander Haig flew in for Sadat's funeral, he took the opportunity to assure Mubarak of American support.
We also had an opportunity to review the overall security situation in the region, and I to emphasize the concern in Washington that events in this region be permitted to proceed without external intervention or mischief-making by externally sponsored activity, and that the nations of this region be permitted their full sovereignty and self-determination as decided by the leaders of the region.
As the Egyptian government arrested hundreds of Muslim fundamentalists whom it said had been involved in the plot to kill Sadat and seize power, the United States moved to shore up Mubarak by dispatching 2 AWACS early warning planes to patrol Egypt's western border with Libya. I'm Edwin Smith.
Cut LN7.
In Northern Ireland, intense violence, a hunger strike, and political disagreement made 1981 the year when the Catholic and Protestant communities became more polarized than at any time in the past 13 years of troubles. The main reason was the provisional IRA hunger strike at the Mays Prison near Belfast. The prisoners began their fasts on March 1st for concessions in the prison regime. They were demanding the right to wear their own clothes, not prison uniform, and to do no routine prison work. Basically, they wanted to be treated as prisoners of war, a demand the British authorities consistently refused. The first hunger striker, Bobby Sands, was elected during his fast to the British Parliament, but his electoral support had no effect on the resolve of the British government, and he died in May. As each hunger striker died, death was followed by serious rioting in Belfast and Londonderry. This led to more deaths outside the prison. The provisional IRA campaign of murder against members of the police and British Army continued as well. By October, 10 hunger strikers had died, but then, as the men in prison lapsed into unconsciousness, their relatives demanded medical treatment for them, and they were kept alive. So the prisoners gave up their protest. Immediately, the British government granted prison concessions, including the right of prisoners to wear their own clothes. Most prisoners are still refusing to do prison work, but the emotive element of the hunger strike, which had so polarized the two communities, was removed. Talks between the Irish and British governments, which had been postponed during the hunger strike, took place in November. British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and Irish Premier Garrett Fitzgerald decided to set up an Anglo-Irish Council of Ministers from both governments as a first step towards reconciliation between the two countries, but also between Northern and Southern Ireland. The Provisional IRA and Loyalist paramilitaries continue their killings as the new British Secretary of State in Ulster, James Pryor, determines to find a political solution to the problems of Northern Ireland, which would mean compromise by both communities. This is Jim Dougal in Belfast.
Cut LN 8.
On Wednesday, the 13th of May, Pope John Paul II was holding his regular audience in St. Peter's Square on the edge of the Vatican City. The square was crowded with thousands of people, many reaching out and trying to touch him as he drove past in the white open truck known as the Popemobile. Then the unthinkable happened. Shots rang out and the Pope was sinking onto his side, a bright red stain spreading across his white cassock. Tourists Howard and Marianne Wheeler were in the crowd.
We were standing next to the fence, the Pope was approaching and standing up in the Jeep. And I told my wife, Marianne, to put her hands up because he would be there in another 2 or 3 seconds. And I was taking pictures of him, and he was 10 feet away, and there were 2 shots. And the Pope crumpled over like this and looked up, very frightened, and then he fell down in the Jeep, and all pandemonium broke loose.
From where they were, they couldn't see the attacker, only hear him.
We didn't see him, but we heard the shots, and they were like firecrackers. The Pope, he looks just shocked, like, what happened? What's going on?
Others, however, did see the gunman. And for the police, it was more a matter of protecting the would-be assassin from the anger of the crowd than of arresting him. For the Pope, this day saw the start of a long battle for recovery, a battle that was to last most of the year. For the authorities, it was the start of an investigation that still remains inconclusive. After the shooting, the Pope was rushed to the Gemelli Hospital, where surgeons spent over 4 hours operating on the pontiff's intestines, which had suffered the worst damage in the shooting. The operation was successful, but it was to be many months before the Pope was once again fit enough to resume his travels. As to his assailant, the only thing about which there was no doubt was the fact that a 23-year-old Turk, Mehmet Ali Agca, fired the shots. Why he did it, however, and who, if anyone, was backing and helping him, remains a mystery. This is Jay Dyer reporting.
Cut LN 9.
Poland has ridden a non-stop roller coaster of crisis and change for nearly a year and a half now, and the end is still far from in sight. Only adding to the situation is the fact that many of the problems, so evident a year or more ago, still have not been solved, and indeed have become more serious. The economic crisis, of course, is foremost, with little having been done to halt the dangerous slump in production. Neither extensive rationing nor formation of an independent farmers' union has helped in improving food supplies. For one thing, the infrastructure and food distribution system is so bad that despite a bumper potato crop, for example, it's still almost impossible to buy potatoes in Warsaw. Solidarity won formal registration as an independent union in the beginning of last November, and almost immediately it was beset by factional infighting and problems for the union's national leadership to control strike activities in the provinces. This still persists, but nonetheless, the nearly 10 million member union has grown into a major political force, while at the same time the beleaguered Communist Party and government have played musical chairs with their leadership in order to try to shore up the terribly weakened authorities. Defense Minister Army General Wojciech Jaruzelski took over as Prime Minister in February, and he became Communist Party chief just 8 months later. The leadership's latest scheme, recognizing the might of solidarity, is to expand the government coalition to include at least indirect participation by the union, a plan some solidarity leaders say may split the organization. After the death of Cardinal Wyszynski in May, his successor as Roman Catholic primate, Archbishop Joseph Glemp, has played a more active role in mediating the strained relations between union and authorities. In the past year, Poland has seen 2 nationwide strikes, a vast liberalization in the media with a proliferation of unofficial publications, an upsurge of nationalistic fervor, constant concern over reaction from the Soviet bloc, and an endless round of confrontation and compromise. Meanwhile, the people have grown frustrated as hardships have dramatically increased, and the path out of the crisis remains as clouded as ever. This is Ruth Gruber in Warsaw.
Cut LN 10.
1981 was the year of Reaganomics, On February 5th, President Reagan told the nation the United States was in the worst economic mess since the Great Depression, and he appealed for support for sweeping spending and tax cuts. 2 weeks later, Mr. Reagan outlined his proposed $659 billion budget for fiscal 1982. That spending plan provided for a $45 billion deficit, budget cuts totaling $41 billion, and an immediate 10% personal tax cut. Initially, opposition was strong, but the president used what some have called the greatest display of salesmanship in White House history to win congressional approval. The tax cut turned out to be the largest in U.S. history, cutting taxes 25% over a three-year period. Many Americans stood by the president and his program for economic recovery. They were finally seeing some steps taken which they hoped would ease the pinch on their pocketbooks. But Mr. Reagan promised no quick fixes and said recovery would take time. In the meantime, problems remained. The Federal Reserve Board continued its tight monetary policy as a means to control inflation, keeping interest rates in double-digit levels. This did cut down spending and pulled inflation back into the single-digit range, but it also put a crimp on the spending plans of business, which had to pay rates of 20% and higher at times to borrow new funds. The most interest rate-sensitive industries took the worst beating. U.S. automakers saw a severe slump in sales as customers couldn't afford to finance cars. The same happened in the housing industry, which is suffering one of its worst periods since World War II. Toward year's end, new construction of single-family homes fell to the lowest level on record, while overall housing starts were at their second lowest level, and the fixed-rate mortgage gradually faded from the scene. The Reagan economic plan suffered a setback in November when Federal Budget Director David Stockman was quoted in Atlantic Monthly magazine as calling the plan a Trojan horse which would benefit the rich. Stockman apologized to the president and offered his resignation, but the president decided to keep him on. Meanwhile, the administration promised noticeable economic recovery beginning in late spring of 1982. Peter Schachnow, New York.